This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Saints for All Occasions by J. Courtney Sullivan. Read for you by Susan Deniker. I exist in two places, here and where you are. Margaret Atwood, Corpse Song. Part 1, 2009. Chapter 1. In the car on the way to the hospital, Nora remembered how, when Patrick was small, she would wake up suddenly, gripped by some terrible fear, that he had stopped breathing or spiked a deadly fever, that he had been taken from her. She had to see him to be sure. They lived then on the top floor of the three-decker on Crescent Avenue. She would practically sleepwalk through the kitchen and past Bridget's door, and then down the hall to the boys' room, her nightgown skimming the cold hardwood, the muffled sound of Mr. Sheehan's radio murmuring up from downstairs. The fear returned the summer Patrick was 16, when they moved to the big house in Hull. Nora would awaken, heart pounding, thinking of him and of her sister. Images past and present wound up in one another. She worried about the crowd he ran with, about his anger and his moods, about things he had done that could never be undone. She met her worries in the same old way. Whatever the hour, she would rise to her feet and climb the attic stairs to Patrick's bedroom so that she might lay eyes on him. This was a bargain she struck, a ritual to guarantee safety. Nothing truly bad could happen if she was expecting it. Over the years, there were times when one of her other three consumed her thoughts. As they got older, Nora knew them better. That was something no one ever told you, that you would have to get to know your own children. John wanted too much to please her. Bridget was a hopeless tomboy. They had carried these traits along with them into adulthood. When Brian, her baby, moved away, Nora worried. She worried ever more so when he moved back in. But it was Patrick who weighed most on her mind. He was 50 now. For the past several months, the old fear had returned. Ever since John kicked things up again, things she had long considered safely in the past. Unable to check on Patrick on those nights when the feeling arose, Nora would switch on the lamp and shuffle through her prayer cards until she came to Saint Monica, patron saint of mothers with difficult children. She slept with the card face up on Charlie's empty pillow. Tonight, for once, she hadn't been thinking of Patrick. Of all things, she was thinking about the boiler down cellar. It had been clanging since just after supper. Adjusting the temperature didn't help. Nora thought she might have to bleed the pipes. As a last resort, she tried saying a rosary to make it stop. When this seemed to do the trick, she went to bed with a fat grin on her face, thus assured of her own powers. She was awakened, not long after, by the ringing telephone. A stranger's voice saying there had been an accident. She should come right away. By the time she reached the emergency room, pink flannel pajamas under her winter coat, Patrick was already gone. The ambulance had taken him to the Kearney. It took Nora 45 minutes to get from home to the old neighborhood. They were waiting for her by the door, a doctor and a nurse and a priest about her age. The presence of the priest made it clear. She thought of how they left Dorchester all those years ago, for Patrick's sake. But as soon as he was old enough, he moved right back. This would be where his life had started, and where it came to an end. They took her to a windowless office. She wanted to tell them she wouldn't go in. But she followed right along and sat down. The doctor looked terribly young for such a job. But then a lot of people were starting to look terribly young to her. He wanted Nora to know that they had tried to revive her son for close to an hour. They had done all they could. He explained in calm detail that Patrick had been drinking, that he lost control of the car and slammed into a concrete wall beneath an overpass on Morrissey Boulevard. His chest struck the steering column. His lungs bled out.
"It could have been worse," the doctor said. "If he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, he would have been ejected from the car."
How could it be any worse than death? She wondered. And yet she clung to this detail. Patrick had worn his seatbelt. He wasn't trying to die. Nora wanted to ask the priest if he thought all her fears had pointed to this moment, or if they had been the thing to stave it off for so long. She felt that she should confess something. Her guilt. She knew they would think she was crazy if she said any of it out loud. She sat there with her lips pressed together, holding her pocketbook tight to her chest like it was a fidgety child. After the signing of papers, the nurse said, "We'll give you a minute with him if you like." She led Nora to a room down the hall and closed the door. Patrick was lying on a gurney, a white blanket covering his body, a breathing tube protruding from his mouth. Someone had closed his eyes. From the hall and the rooms all around came the beeping of machines, the scurry of feet and low voices, a burst of laughter from the nurse's station. But in this room, everything was impossibly settled, final, still. Nora tried to recall what the doctor had said. It seemed that if she could just piece it together, figure out what was to blame, she might still have him back. She felt overcome with anger toward John. She returned to that moment last May, when he first asked if she remembered the McLean family from Savin Hill. Their oldest son had approached John to run his campaign for state senate. "They weren't very nice people," she said. "I don't think you should do it." What she meant was, don't do it. But John went right ahead. It had led to that terrible fight at Maeve's confirmation. Patrick and John hadn't spoken since. Patrick hadn't been himself. Nora had seen another article in the paper just yesterday, a slight agitation taking root in her chest, as it did whenever she saw Rory McLean's name in print. There was a photograph of Rory, looking every bit the politician, that face so familiar to her, all black hair and toothy smile. His wife stood by his side, and three teenage boys lined up according to height. Nora wondered if beneath the collared shirts and school picture day haircuts, they were as wicked as their father and grandfather had once been. It seemed to her that a duplicitous nature must run in a family, like twins or weak knees. She hadn't read the article, though she knew John would call to make sure she had seen it. Nora turned the page. She took in a deep breath now and told herself to put these thoughts aside. There wasn't much time left. Patrick had had a horrible mustache for the last 2 years, despite her begging him to shave it off. She let her hand hover in the air just above it, so as to hide the proof, and then she looked at him. She looked and looked. He had always been handsome, the most beautiful of all her children. After a while, the nurse knocked twice, then opened the door. "It's time, I'm afraid," she said. Nora pulled a small plastic hairbrush from her purse and smoothed his black curls. She checked his pulse, in case. She felt as if a swarm of bees were darting around inside her, but she managed to let Patrick go, as she had on other occasions when it felt impossible. When he was 5 and frightened about the first day of kindergarten, she slipped a seashell into his pocket as the yellow school bus came into view. "To get you through," she said. In the fluorescent-lit hallway, the priest placed a hand on her shoulder.
"You're in better shape than most, Mrs. Rafferty," he said. "You're a tough cookie, I can tell. No tears."
Nora didn't say anything. She had never been able to cry in front of other people. And anyway, tears never came right away at a moment like this. Not when her mother died when she was a child, and not when her husband died 5 years ago, and not when her sister went away, which was not a death, but something close to it.
"Where in Ireland are you from?"
he asked, and when she stared back blankly, he said,
"Your accent."
"County Clare," she said.
"Ah, my mother came from County Mayo."
The priest paused.
"He's in a better place."
Why did they send the clergy at times like this? By design, they could never understand. Her sister had been just the same. Nora pictured her in full black habit. Did they even wear those anymore? She would wake up this morning at that tranquil country abbey, free from all attachment, free from heartache, even though she had been the one to set the thing in motion. All the way home, unable to think of how she would tell the children, Nora thought of her sister. Her rage was like another person sitting beside her in the car. When the children were young, Charlie was always telling stories about home. The one they liked best was about the bone setter.
"Did I ever tell you who came when you broke a bone in Milton Marby?"
he would ask. They would shake their heads, even though they'd heard it before.
"The bone setter,"
he'd cry, clasping the closest child in his arms, the child squealing in delight.
"You didn't go to the doctor unless you were dying," he said. "No, if you broke something like I did, my ankle, this fine man would come to your bedroom and snap you right back into place with his hands, as good as new."
Charlie made a popping sound with his tongue.
"No drugs. Didn't need them."
The children went green when he told it, but then they begged him to tell it again. As usual, when he spoke of home, Charlie left out the worst bits. The man had set his ankle slightly off. It led the rest of his body to be out of balance, so that eventually his knees bothered him, and later his back. The lies they had told were like this. The original, her sister's doing. All those that followed, an attempt on Nora's part to try to preserve what the first lie had done, each one putting Patrick ever more out of joint. She had accepted it as the price of keeping him safe. John always complained that Nora favored Patrick. Bridget said that until she was 5 years old, she thought his name was My Patrick, since that's all Nora ever called him. She had thought that someday they would understand, They would know the whole story. Though she could not imagine telling it. Patrick had asked, but she could never bring herself to answer. She hadn't even told them that she had a sister. Her mind wandered again to the Abbey. Those women outside the world, capable of casting off everything, even their own names. Nora had realized long ago that the walls the nuns used to keep others out could just as easily wall a person in, imprison her with her thoughts. Let her sit with this, then, the weight of it. It wasn't right that Nora should have to carry it on her own. As soon as she reached the house, she went to the junk drawer and found her old address book. She called the Abbey for the first time in more than 30 years. She told the young one who answered that her name was Nora Rafferty, and she needed Mother Cecilia Flynn to know that her son Patrick had died late last night in a car crash, alone. Outside she could hear the first of the commuters driving down the hill, headed for the highway that would take them to the city, or else to the ferry, where they'd drink a cup of coffee as the boat cut a course across the darkened harbor. Nora took a notepad from the counter and made a list. She brewed a pot of tea in case company should arrive sooner than expected. She sat down and wept, her elbows on the table, her face cupped in the cool palms of her hands. Part 2, 1957 to 1958. Chapter 2. Their father hired a hackney to drive them as far as Ennistymon. From there, a bus would carry them the rest of the way to Cope. At 6 in the morning, he stood smoking by the kitchen window, tapping his foot, waiting for Cedric McGann's black Ford to come chugging up the road. Nora hadn't slept. While the house was silent, by the light of an oil lamp, she made certain they had everything they needed. She checked 3 times to be sure. Now, their suitcases by the door, she sat at the table, hoping he might tell her not to go. But her father wouldn't look at her. "Are you all right?" she managed to ask.
"Right as the mail," he said.
An hour ago, she had fixed him a boiled egg. It was still on the plate, untouched. In one of his letters, Charlie said his father's cousin in Boston was a marvelous cook, that Nora had never seen the likes of her food. Nora had told her father that the woman was strict, so he wouldn't worry. But in fact, Charlie reported that she barely noticed the family members who came to stay. Girls lived on the second floor, and boys on the third. And as long as you minded your manners, Mrs. Quinlan didn't bother you. Charlie said they wouldn't live in her house for long. Once they were married, they would get their own apartment. "What about Teresa?" she asked him when she wrote.
"She can come with us if you like," he replied, "or she can stay on at Quinlan's. We won't be going far."
Nora watched her father at the window. She felt like there had been a death, that mix of sorrow and anticipation that arose to fill the space when someone vanished. Her sister came bounding into the room, giddy, wearing her nicest dress. Nora was about to tell her to have some porridge to fill herself up for the journey. "Oh!" Teresa shouted as she reached the threshold. "My hat!" She ran out as quickly as she'd come in.
"Quiet," their father called after her in a hush. "You'll wake herself."
Their gran had said her goodbyes the night before. She said she couldn't stand to see them go, didn't want to hold the memory of it. When the taxi arrived, Nora thought that she would simply not leave. How could your legs walk someplace when you had no desire to make them? Yet here she was, placing one foot in front of the other, body betraying mind, exchanging a long embrace with her father and a quick one with her brother, who slunk out of his room at the last minute, head down. Martin had been protesting their leaving ever since it was decided upon, ignoring his two sisters, as if rehearsing for a life in which they no longer existed. Her father's eyes were glazed with tears that threatened to spill over, but wouldn't. He looked tired. He looked old, his face brown and leathered from the sun. He had terrified Nora when she was a girl, once her mother was gone, his temper raging over a cup of spilled milk as if his children were a punishment. They ran screaming. They hid from him in corners of the house he could not reach, behind heavy furniture, or under their grandmother's bed, a meaty, menacing hand coming toward them. A child had no choice but to forgive. And he could be kind in his way. He took them fishing, taught them how to pull a trout from the water with their bare hands. Every summer, he brought them to the Milltown races and gave them each a penny to bet on whichever horse they chose. He liked that Teresa was bold. He didn't discourage her. Only Nora did, trying to teach her how to behave properly, the way their mother would have done. But Teresa and Martin hadn't known their mother long enough. She didn't get the time to shape them as she had Nora. Before she died, she told Nora that the younger ones were her responsibility. Maybe she only said it so Nora would have something to hold on to, so she wouldn't feel as lost. But Nora took the job seriously, even though they didn't mind her most of the time. She wasn't firm, forceful, like their mother had been. She could never quite convince them of her authority. As she grew, Nora feared her father less. She became more like his equal in the house once she started earning. They'd talk over breakfast about the farm and the girls at work. Her father laughed easily, recounting the story of some barroom brawl back in his youth. She saw that he was not such a large man at all. He was slight by most standards, his fair hair and eyebrows making him look almost boyish when he grinned. She learned that he was not the same man after a given hour, after he poured himself a whiskey, then a second, then a third. She liked her father best in the morning, when she could be certain of him. From the front hall, he turned his head now and said,
"Teresa, where are you? Come on."
Nora looked to see her sister standing in the doorway of the bedroom they had shared for 17 years, since Teresa was born. The bedroom walls were a bright, bright blue. They framed Teresa in the morning light like a portrait of the Virgin. She and Nora had all the same features, the same wide blue eyes and thin lips and brown curls. But Nora thought that somehow they were arranged in a more pleasing manner on Teresa's face than her own. When she was very young and afraid of the dark, Teresa would crawl into Nora's bed in the night and cling to her. Nora would moan and pretend to shake her off, but in truth, she liked the warmth and the comfort. She knew Teresa's body as well as she knew her own. Better. Nora had bathed her as a girl, brushed the knots from her hair. When Teresa fell, Nora was the one to dab iodine onto her scrapes as she roared the house down.
"I can't find it," Teresa said. "Help me. You know the one. It has a pink silk flower at the brim."
"Leave it," Nora said. "It's 6:30. Their father handed them each a bit of money. Teresa slipped hers into her coat pocket and kissed his cheek. Nora thanked him and then put the bill into the toe of his empty boot by the door when he wasn't looking. He would find it later, and need it. He was always making gestures he shouldn't be, offering to buy a round of drinks at Friel's when they didn't have enough money for sugar and flour, donating to someone's charity fund when, in fact, they needed the charity themselves. Even the Hackney was a luxury he couldn't afford, but there was no other way to get there with the luggage. She had already determined to send the fare back to him on top of whatever else she could manage. She had told her brother to watch him, to make sure he was careful. But Martin was only 19. Who knew if he had any sense about him? The men carried the bags out. Nora and Teresa followed. Cedric McGann stood by the car. He was the brother of a girl she had known at school. She had seen him at the dances plenty of times. But still, she felt her cheeks go red when he said, "Morning, Nora." A week ago, she had vowed never to blush again, something she did at the most ridiculous times, moments when any other woman wouldn't feel in the least bit flummoxed. She blushed when she went into Jones's Market and had to stand at the counter and ask Cyril Jones for the tea. She blushed when Father Donahue looked her in the eye as he placed a communion wafer on her tongue. Charlie had said you could make yourself over in America, leave behind all that you didn't like. Yet here she was, not yet to the front gate, and already it was clear that Nora was stuck with herself.
"Hello, Cedric,"
Teresa said, a teasing note to her voice as if they had some secret between them, which Nora knew for a fact they did not. She was grateful anyway that Teresa had taken his mind off her.
"What was the final score in the football last night?" her father said. 12-2, Cedric said. "I got knocked about some, but it was worth it. That a boy."
Her father's tone was light, as if Cedric were only here to drive the girls to a dance in La Hinch and home again. Nora looked back at the low stone walls separating one farm from the next, cutting a jagged line down the green hills for miles, until the green faded into sea and sky. In the foreground were the barns that sheltered the cows, the donkey, the pigs and hens, animals Teresa had named, though their father told her not to. She looked at the stone cottage. They were all born in this house. Their mother had died here. Nora set her eyes on her grandmother's bedroom window to see if she was peeking out through the yellow curtains for one last look at Teresa, her favorite, everyone's favorite. But the curtains were still. Nora wished her father would hug her once more, even if it had to be in front of Cedric.
"Be brave, my girl," he said instead.
She knew he said it because she was not brave, not in the least.
"I will," Nora said.
"And look after Teresa," he told her,
instructions that had been given to Nora every day since memory began.
"I will."
On summer mornings from the time they were small, Nora led her brother and sister across the fields and went to the sea with all the other kids in town. There was often a moment when Teresa swam out so far that Nora's chest tightened, watching, waiting for her head to break through the surface of the water. Just as she began to panic and got to her feet, Teresa emerged, laughing. She was the youngest, born without fear. It wasn't quite right to say that Teresa was bad, though she could be. She was simply the most brave and beautiful and brash and clever, even the most devout in her way. As a child, She had memorized the lives of the saints. Now she was a flirt, devoting all the attention she had once given to the martyrs to the boys of Milltown Malby. While Nora went to the holy hour each day, Teresa snuck off to go walking with Gareth O'Shaughnessy. Plenty of girls did the same, but only Teresa was bold enough to ride right up to the church gates afterwards, perched on the handlebars of Gareth's bicycle, asking, "Who said the rosary? Come on, tell me quick before I see Daddy and he asks. I'll be killed." Whatever age Teresa was, Nora had been there already. Teresa always managed to get more out of things, to do it better somehow. Nora had been a day pupil at the convent school until her father couldn't afford it any longer. She never got beyond the 10th grade. At 15, she went to work at the knitwear factory on the edge of town. Teresa earned a scholarship and graduated with the highest marks. The nuns said teaching was a calling, a vocation of sorts, and Teresa had it. If they had the money, she would be on to Limerick by now for her degree. As it was, she had joined Nora at the factory. For years, Nora had worked 8 hours a day on her feet at the pressing machine, hot steam rising up into her eyes, her fingertips singed red by the end of the week. She had never considered the job beneath her. She felt lucky to have it, when so many people she knew had no work at all. But she hated to see Teresa there, watching the clock for the 10-minute break like everyone else, sitting in a row of girls at their sewing machines, a lady's cardigan or jumper on the table in front of her, something they themselves could never afford, which would be shipped off to Pennies or to Dunn's with all the rest. Old Ben Dunn himself, president of the store, visited the factory to thank them every year. Nora had always thought it was quite an honor. But when he came and she saw him smile at her sister, she thought of how he had no idea of the potential in her. Teresa stayed up late every night reading books lent to her by an old teacher, a nun. This pleased Nora, though she told her to get to sleep, that she'd be exhausted in the morning. In the back seat of the car now, Nora reached for her sister's hand and held it tight without a word, without a glance. They drove the mile into town. She was used to traveling this road on foot or on her bicycle, dirt puffing in clouds at her ankles, staining the ruffled edges of her white socks. Passing by the Rafferty farm, she imagined Charlie's parents and his brother sitting down to breakfast. She felt pure spite in her heart, though she would never say so. If it weren't for their decision, she wouldn't have to go. Nora had expected her life to take a certain path. She and Charlie would be married and live on the farm beside her father's. She could look in on him and her brother each day. She thought her children would grow up as she had, knowing the names of every wildflower, climbing, 3 or 4 of them on a single bicycle, coasting down the hill to Spanish Point. Nora told herself to let this be the last of her protestations. She would soon be Charlie's wife, though the fact of it felt more impossible than the ocean crossing. She had run into an old school friend on a recent Sunday while walking home from church with her sister, Aoife, newly fat and bouncing a baby on her hip. "Soon it will be you, Nora," she said. "I hope Charlie's a better father than my George. He's gone off to wet the baby's head at the pub every day since he was born." Nora felt sick to her stomach, imagining her first child born in Boston, a place she'd never been, a city full of strangers. Charlie, more or less, one of them now. "I'm afraid I'll have another before long," Aoife said and laughed.
The things they never told us in school.
What did she mean? Teresa asked after they'd parted.
Never mind it, Nora said. She herself only knew because her best friend Una had explained things after an older cousin explained them to her. Someday, Nora would tell Teresa, when it was time for her to know. It was just after 7 when they reached town. On Main Street, the pubs and the parish hall and Jones's grocery were shut, and would be for another hour yet. She had never seen it so empty. Most of the houses scattered around the area were low and built of gray slate. The row of shops on Main Street offered the only color. The butcher's was a pale yellow. Jones's was bright green. There were pubs and hotels painted white or gold, light blue or pink. Once a month, on a fair day, this road filled with farmers selling cabbages and cows, their voices shouting out a price, an exclamation of disappointment or of victory, depending. The next morning, the street would stink to high heaven, the gutters clogged with manure. The shopkeepers would grumble, and you'd think the town would never be put right again. But a day or two later, it looked like nothing had ever happened. In the spring, when the bishop came for confirmation, orange bunting was strung from one high window to another across the way, all up and down the road. Classes at school were suspended for weeks so the students could study their catechism. The bishop asked them each 3 questions. Most children stood before him, sweating, trembling, hoping to get an easy one, praying they knew the answer. When Teresa was 12 and her turn came, she stood up straight and confident. She met the bishop's eye. He asked,
"How many sacraments does the church recognize?"
7, she said, and went on to deliver them from memory.
"What happens if you die in a state of mortal sin?"
Again, the answer came straight away. "You go to hell," Teresa said. "But a mortal sin can be forgiven through the sacrament of penance." Nora could see he was impressed. For the final question, he asked,
"What happens at the sacrifice of the Mass?"
Teresa said, "The bread and wine are changed into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus when the priest repeats the words of consecration spoken at the Last Supper. In this way, the sacrifice on the cross that Jesus offered on Calvary is made present again so that we can join in offering it to the Father and receive its benefits."
"Well done," the bishop said.
Afterward, Nora overheard him say to her father,
"You've got a very bright child there. Are all your others as sharp as that?" "Heavens no, we don't know where she came from."
It didn't hurt Nora to hear him say it. She had lived in her younger sister's shadow most of her life. She had never much minded it there. Nora scolded Teresa all the time. She grew exasperated by her every day. But if you were shy and quiet, mere proximity to someone so sparkling did something for you. In Teresa's presence, she became less terrified of everyone and everything. Her sister spoke for her when she was too afraid to speak for herself. They reached the intersection at the center of town. If they turned right from here, they would come to the church and the cemetery and onward into 20 miles of farmland. To the left was the National School and then farms beyond, eventually spilling out to the beach. Cedric went straight, on to the flag road, toward St. Joseph's Holy Well, where Nora's gran used to dip bits of cloth into the water, hoping they might heal her only daughter. Nora closed her eyes. She didn't want to see the 3rd farmhouse on the left up ahead, the white stucco with red flowers in the window boxes that belonged to her best friend, Una Coogan.
Una Donnelly now.
Teresa had loads of friends. Nora had Una, and wouldn't have traded her for all the rest of them combined. They had spent every day together at the convent school as girls, and at the factory these past 6 years. Una was one of 9 children, and like Nora, she was the oldest. For years, she had been on and off with Connell Davis, but months ago, without warning, Una's father had forced her to marry an old farmer with a good bit of land. Una didn't meet the man until 2 days before the wedding. That morning, as her mother rushed around hanging rosary beads from trees and delivering eggs to the poor Clares to ward off rain, Una cried bitterly to Nora up in her bedroom, wearing her white dress. After the wedding, she told Nora how the farmer barely talked to her. He hated Una's cooking, her heavy footsteps, the pitch of her voice. She dreaded evenings when he came in for his tea, and she dreaded what he expected of her after they'd gone to bed.
"I don't know how I'll manage when you leave," Una told Nora. "I'll have nobody."
Now Teresa said,
"Stop, Cedric. Stop the car."
Nora opened her eyes to see Una standing at the edge of the road. She climbed quickly from the car, and they embraced so long and hard that she thought perhaps they'd miss the bus, and then the boat in turn. Una had made them a sweet cake for the journey.
"I'll write to you every day," she said.
"I'll do the same," Nora said.
As they pulled apart, Una pressed a note into her hand.
"For when you get lonesome."
Back in the taxi, Nora said a prayer for her friend. It was hideous what Una's father had done. Nora supposed her own parents had been a made match, but that was the fashion then. It shouldn't happen to a girl anymore. Then again, maybe her situation wasn't much different. Charlie was not a bad man, but theirs was no great love story. From an early age, Nora had understood that the farm would go to her brother, that she and Teresa were expected to do their part, to marry, to vanish. There were things that were never discussed. This was why her father would not meet her eye. What would there be to remind her now of all that she had known? Her memories were here, ignited by the sight of a specific shop or house or corner. Her melancholy led her down a road that ended at her mother. Nora felt the absence of her, total in some way now. She began to cry. Teresa said,
"Come on, Sue. We'll be back before long."
Nora wondered if her sister believed it. She tried to picture Milltown Malbay as a bird might see it from above, tried to press every bit of the town into her memory. She supposed Teresa was doing just the opposite, soaking up what was around them right this moment. The scent of Cedric McGann's cologne and the grumbling engine and the houses up ahead coming into view. The bus to Cove smelled of herring. A man in the second row had brought it for his lunch, and the odor traveled 10 rows back to where she and Teresa sat. Outside the window, the sun shone over vast cliffs as they traversed the coast. In 2 hours, Nora saw more of Ireland than she had seen in her 21 years. They came to villages where an electric light shone out through the odd kitchen window. One by one, they were wiring the small towns. Milltown Malbay could have had electricity a year ago, but everyone in a parish had to want it unanimously, and Mrs. Madigan on Church Street had refused to pay. She said her sister in Roscommon had gotten electric lights, and now she could tell that her house was full of cobwebs no matter how she cleaned.
"You're so quiet," Teresa said. "Are you thinking about Charlie?"
From across the aisle, an old woman looked up from her knitting and stared at Nora, awaiting her response.
"No," she whispered.
"Liar,"
Teresa said.
"Really, I wasn't."
They exchanged a glance. They laughed. She suspected Teresa knew something about how she felt, though Nora had never told her. When she was 18, Charlie Rafferty kissed her as they were walking home from a dance. From then on, they were an item. They met for walks down on the beach and at the dances, though they pretended not to be there just for each other. Nora didn't fancy him particularly. Charlie was silly. When they were young, at Christmas time, he ran around with the Wren boys going house to house in masks, singing carols, his brother Lawrence on the tin whistle. They wouldn't leave a person alone until he'd paid. Nora's father said he'd have whipped any one of his children had they joined in with that bunch. Charlie was older now, but he still told horrible jokes and pulled pranks on his friends. He laughed too loud, embarrassing Nora, as if the sound was coming out of her mouth instead of his. She knew why he had chosen her, when there were more outgoing girls, prettier girls. She had wanted him for the same reason. Nora had never been a romantic like her sister, her head full of fantasies. The one thing she and Charlie had in common was practicality. They wanted the same sort of life. She could tolerate his quirks, endure his manner for the sake of getting to see her father, her gran, her sister and brother, her best friend every day. Their farms stood side by side. Joining the land would be good for both families. A husband didn't matter that much compared to all the rest. Most of the married couples she knew hardly seemed to interact, especially after the children came. The Flynns and the Raffertys had helped each other down through the years, the friendship between them stretching back to the town's founding and solidified in 1888, when the pub owners and shopkeepers boycotted the local landlord, Maroney, refusing to serve his people. The shopkeepers were thrown in jail, including Miles and Henry Rafferty, Charlie's great-grandfather and his brother, who ran the butcher shop in town but were needed home on the farm at the weekend. The pair was imprisoned for the better part of 2 years. It was John Flynn, Nora's great-grandfather, who vowed to help keep the farm alive in their absence, going over each day with his three brothers after working their own land. Years later, Henry Rafferty went to America. Once established, he began bringing relatives over from home. Now, as most young people in the town headed to Liverpool or London, the Rafferty children went to Boston. Charlie's sister Kitty and three of his brothers had been there for years. Charlie had no intention of joining them. He thought America was crowded, hectic, morally corrupt. Kitty had run off and married a Protestant from California, a man she barely knew. The episode caused Charlie and the rest of them no end of heartache. "They get there and they think it's a dream," he said. "They get there and they just run wild." Until a year ago, the only Rafferty children left in Ireland were Charlie and his oldest brother Peter, who spent most afternoons on a bar stool inside Friel's. It was Charlie who did the work, devoting himself to the family land like it was his birthright. More than once his father had said,
"Someday this will be yours."
Nora turned 19, 20.
Then Charlie proposed down on the beach, on bended knee and all. A pointless gesture. They both knew they couldn't be married until the land was passed to him. Nora waited. She did what she could to help her father, but she knew he couldn't go on with 3 grown children in the house much longer. She gave him most of what she made at the factory, but it wasn't enough. She hung back at the dinner table, going to bed hungry some nights, though she didn't let anyone see. Once a year, her father shot a pig, or her brother Martin did it. Teresa would cover her ears to block out the animal's scream. Dinner was always a single rasher cut down for each of them, the salt rubbed off, the rest fried in a pan and served with brown bread and turnip. As a year wore on, the rashers got smaller and smaller to make them last. One Sunday morning after Mass, Nora found Charlie waiting for her in the churchyard. From the look on his face, she thought someone must have died. She knew her gran was inside, hoping to get her face seen by the visiting Monsignor. Who, then? His father? Her father? Who? She asked. My father said last night that he's getting tired, Charlie said slowly, precisely. He's ready to hand down the farm.
Charlie, that's grand.
She pictured herself and Una hanging curtains in his mother's sunny kitchen, herself and Una drinking tea in the garden.
He's decided Peter will get it. He says Peter is the oldest, and that's how his own father did it.
But Peter will...
It doesn't matter, he said.
He looked like he would cry if Nora went on, so she stayed silent, even as her head filled with questions. His father had told him he should go to America.
That was it, she thought. He had come to break it off with her.
But Charlie said he had worked out a plan. He would go ahead to Boston and get them situated. When he was ready, he would send for Nora.
We'll be back before long, he said, with enough money to buy a farm of our own, bigger than our 2 fathers' farms combined.
She was stunned that he wanted the 2 of them to carry on. She didn't know what to say. Nora had never given much thought to America. Only when she was 7 and Una received a talking doll for Christmas from her aunt in Chicago. It was the first talking doll anyone in town had ever seen. Nora wished then that she had an aunt in America. She had even lied and told Una that she did. Her strongest urge was to tell Charlie they should end it. She knew people who had lost a boyfriend, a girlfriend, when someone went away. Charlie had to go, and that was that. Nora went with her family more than she did with him. She loved them more, owed them more. But Charlie wanted to stay together. He was one to get used to things. His brothers had married their first sweethearts, and he would do the same. At home that evening, she told her father what Charlie had said. Nora assumed he would tell her she was needed here. She thought he would forbid her to leave. But instead, he said,
"You'll have to go with him. You're engaged to be married."
Nora thought of Teresa. She couldn't let her sister end up the woman of the house, working in the factory, waiting on the men for the rest of her life. Her father didn't have a clue how to raise her. And for all her flirting, Teresa didn't know a thing. Nora had protected her as best she could. She recalled how Father Boyle came to lecture to the first-year class at the convent school each year. He liked to lean over a girl from behind while she was seated at her desk doing the reading. He'd hover there, looking left and right, howling at anyone who dared to lift her eyes from the page. They all stared down, though they knew just what was happening. The girl he singled out could feel his breath in her ear. Ever so lightly, he'd place a hand on her shoulder and run it down, down into her dress, making no sound, cupping her breast, his cold and clammy skin against hers, soft and warm. He'd leave his hand there for an agonizing moment before drawing it away, shouting,
"Now, girls, what have we learned?"
He always chose the prettiest girl. In Nora's year, it had been poor Una. Una never told a soul besides her. She said her mother would have blamed her. You didn't question a priest. Whatever he did was justified by God, by his position. Nora knew her own father wouldn't believe such a thing was even possible. When Teresa had to go into his class, Nora couldn't stomach the thought of what he would do to her. She made a bodice out of cloth and feathers, a pillow to the thickness of a slice of bread. It clung tight to Teresa's chest, bound to her skin from waist to collar. When Father Boyle tried his old trick, he found that there was no way into her. She wore a soft suit of armor beneath her clothes. "I could never go to Boston without my sister," Nora told Charlie before he left. It seemed to her like a barrier he could not overcome. But he said he would save enough for both their passages. He told Nora she could come first, and in time they would bring Teresa. Nora told him she would wait until they could travel together. It came to her then, a reason to go. In America, Teresa might become a teacher as she was meant to, a woman their mother would be proud of. Charlie's mother thought they should be married before he went away. She said it wasn't proper for a girl to cross an ocean based on only a promise. But Nora said there wasn't enough time. Charlie's father's cousin in Boston, Mrs. Quinlan, said she'd never had anyone but family come to stay. As it was, her guest rooms were always full. But she agreed to take Nora and Teresa in for a short while, as long as Nora and Charlie were married soon after they reunited. While they were apart, Charlie wrote her letters, and she did the same. The letters took a week to arrive. The conversation was disjointed. He told her about the city, about the job he'd gotten, painting houses with his cousins. He said it was easy work most days, compared to what they had to do on the farm. Sometimes, holding a thin blue envelope in her hand, Nora imagined it contained a message telling her that he had found someone else, that she wouldn't be going after all. It took 11 months for him to save the money and make the arrangements. He wrote then and told her to prepare. He said the timing was good. Another relative had just moved out. There was an empty room in the house for Nora and Teresa. Mrs. Quinlan had helped Charlie secure jobs for them both in a dressmaker's shop. Charlie promised it wouldn't be forever. He said Nora would like Boston, for as long as they were there.
"I'll never get used to how different it is. You turn a knob on the kitchen sink, and hot water flows right out. There's no carrying water from the pump or boiling it in the kettle to clean the clothes. That's just one of a million little miracles that everyone here takes for granted. You won't believe it, Nora. I can't wait for you to see."
The town of Cove was busy and bustling. Brightly colored shops and houses were crowded into the hillside, a gray cathedral looming over all. They sat on a bench by the pier for hours, watching the fishing boats and the ships passing by. Nora felt exhausted already, and the real journey hadn't yet begun. 6 days at sea, and on the other side of it, a world she